Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses American Republican senators.
Well, you know, Netanyahu was apparently very offended by Chuck Schumer's comments that, you know, Netanyahu was not good for Israel and that he was doing a disservice to Israel. And so he, when he spoke to the Republicans, he made that very clear.
Plus, Russian missiles target Kyiv.
Actually, I've heard the missile approaching, so it was, you know, such intimidating sound that, you know, one cannot realize if it's too far or not too far.
And later, the EU summit, Haiti, and coral bleaching in the Pacific. Today is Thursday, March 20th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. More aid landed in Gaza, dropped from planes on Thursday, as Washington launched a new diplomatic push for a ceasefire deal that could free hostages and bring in food aid to ward off famine in the Gaza Strip. 5 months of war have created critical food shortages among Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinian residents that in some areas now exceed famine levels, according to the United Nations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Cairo on Thursday as part of talks with Arab officials to seek a ceasefire in Gaza. This after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told U.S. Senate Republicans there would be no let-up in the war against Hamas. I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for more context on the negotiations and the deepening rift between Netanyahu and American Democrats.
Well, you know, Netanyahu was apparently very offended by Chuck Schumer's comments that, you know, Netanyahu was not good for Israel and that he was doing a disservice to Israel. And so he, when he spoke to the Republicans, he made that very clear. And at least according to the Israeli press, the Republicans are thinking of inviting him to address a joint session of Congress. And I think that, you know, a lot of people tend to agree with Netanyahu on this one. They feel that Chuck Schumer's remarks were a bit over the top and that Israelis feel that the United States is sort of treating Israel a little bit as a banana republic. Netanyahu has a very low public approval rating right now. People are not supportive of his conduct of the war. They're not supportive of him. They think he should take responsibility. They think there should be new elections in Israel. And yet they were still a little bit offended and a little bit angry by Chuck Schumer's comments. At the same time, I think that it shows something. And what I think has resonated here even more is President Biden saying that's a good speech. And President Biden saying that Israel should send a team to discuss the potential invasion of Rafah. So I think that it's sort of a sign of tensions between the U.S. administration and Israel, which is a more significant issue for Israel.
Well, and the invasion of Rafah is the next thing I wanted to bring up. Netanyahu says essentially that there's no way to defeat Hamas without going into Rafah, where the last remnants of their fighters are. And Biden, along with many in the international community, are saying not to do that, that the civilian cost would be too high.
Yes. I mean, I think what everybody is sort of hoping is that there will be a ceasefire before any Israeli invasion. The last couple of days, there have been more reports that there's optimism about the possibility of at least the first stage of a possible ceasefire. I think the United States is making it pretty clear that it does not want Israel to enter Rafah. And I find it hard to believe that Israel would do that without American support. In addition, it's something that's going to take quite a while to organize. I mean, Israel says it's going to move the civilians. There are up to 1.5 million civilians that it's going to move them to safe areas, but without any real plan to do that. In addition, there are right now a lot of soldiers in Gaza. Israel has released almost all of the reserve forces in Gaza. So, you know, it doesn't seem like it's imminent in any case. And it could be that Netanyahu is sort of looking for a way to climb down. At the same time, you know, most Israelis see this war as an existential war. Hamas still has 4 battalions in Gaza. So I think that, you know, Israel feels that after all of this time and, you know, the heavy civilian price the Palestinians have paid, the price the soldiers have paid, the thousands and thousands of rockets that Hamas has fired, that Israel wants to make sure to finish the job, whatever that means.
And you touched on the last thing I want to discuss, and that's Secretary Blinken's latest diplomatic push. He left Saudi Arabia. He was visiting with President al-Sisi in Egypt earlier on Thursday. What's the latest? Where do the negotiations stand?
So there are two issues on the agenda for Blinken's trip. The first is a deal in which as part of a ceasefire, Israel and Saudi Arabia would normalize relations and the Saudis would get a defense pact with the United States. Now, that would only happen after a ceasefire in Gaza. But if it does happen, that's a huge issue for Israel. Israel sort of sees it as its way for, you know, becoming really part of the Middle East and really, you know, widespread peace agreements, much more than the Abraham Accords, with which Israel already has with Dubai and with the United Arab Emirates. The other issue is the ceasefire and the hostage release. For Israelis, the hostages are a huge, huge issue. Israel wants them out. They're not sure even how many of them are still alive, but it wants them out. It wants the bodies back. And in exchange, Israel is willing to pay quite a heavy price in terms of releasing Palestinian prisoners and a ceasefire. Now, Blinken was not supposed to come to Israel on this trip. It was supposed to be just Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and he changed his schedule and is coming to Israel tomorrow, which seems to indicate that there's some movement on both the ceasefire deal and the Saudi Arabian deal.
Blinken is also discussing the idea of the two-state solution and the setting up, the managing of, and the governing of an independent, demilitarized Palestinian state. I understand Netanyahu has said he's against that, but generally, the Israeli public, where do they stand?
Well, if you had asked the Israeli public before the war, you probably would have gotten, you know, somehow, and so, you know, a lot of this is also how the question is phrased. Maybe, you know, 50-50, 40 in favor, 60 against. Since the war, any Israeli support for an independent Palestinian state has gone all the way down. I mean, I think that it will be very hard for Israelis to accept any kind of a Palestinian state unless they really feel secure. Now, if there was a way that the international community or the United States would be able to make them feel secure, and as you said, it would be demilitarized, but I think it's going to take a long time.
VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
Meanwhile, the war in Ukraine rages on as well. For the first time in weeks, the capital city, Kyiv, was the target of Russian missiles. VOA's Anna Chernikova is there.
Well, it was a really tough night for Ukraine and Kyiv, particularly because air raid alarm went off across Ukraine, so every region was under danger. But at first, the missiles were targeting a western part of the country, and everyone were expecting the explosion there. And then at one point, suddenly, all of the missiles just turned back and turned to the direction of the capital. And it was really, really tough night because 31 missiles in total were launched by Russian forces just on Kyiv itself, and Ukrainian air defense destroyed all of them. At this point, we have confirmation about 13 people injured. No one was killed. Also, what is interesting, Ukrainian authorities, particularly Kyiv authorities, report that almost 25,000 people were hiding in the subway this night, and this including 3,000 children. And this is actually looks like a really realistic number, because a lot of footage on social media or on different channels are actually featuring people hiding in the subway, and it was quite an impressive footage to see in the morning.
Now, Anna, what goes on in the subway stations, in bomb shelters, when crowds of people are in there for a night?
Well, normally people just gather together and read news. So everyone is just basically checking out the information. Also, a lot of children usually, I mean, it depends, of course, on the timing, but quite often children are singing just to entertain themselves and playing with pets, because also there are a lot of pets. People come with their pets to the subway stations. So, you know, just I think that it's more about, you know, being in safe place and also being together, being, you know, united. This is what helps a lot.
And how close were the debris falls to where you were?
Well, this time it was a different neighborhood, but well, I can say, well, probably less than 7 kilometers, 7-10 kilometers away from my neighborhood. But the explosion was a couple of explosions, particularly were extremely powerful and very loud. It was very loud in my neighborhood as well. I can say that even, you know, a little bit of shaking was present of the building. I mean, so it was quite a scary moment. And also, I think that this time, what was a little bit different from previous times, that actually I've heard the missile approaching. So it was, you know, such intimidating sound that, you know, one cannot realize if it's too far or not too far. And then in about a half a minute, you hear an explosion. So, well, I guess it was quite close because everything is just happening, you know, in the radius of residential areas, and every neighborhood actually was affected anyway.
And the last thing I want to ask you about today is you did a story for television, for VOA TV, about the Ukrainian public's reaction to Vladimir Putin's re-election in Russia. It's on the website. People can go there and watch it. What can they expect to see? What are you showing?
Well, basically, Ukrainian reaction to that, because, of course, in Ukraine, it was not a surprise that Vladimir Putin will just continue his power in Russia. Also, what was the most troubling moment, you know, in this election, that they took place on the occupied territories of Ukraine. And for Ukrainians, this was probably the most, you know, important thing to pay attention to and to, you know, remind the whole world about, because it was, you know, quite a huge breach of international law. So, so you will just hear Ukrainian reaction from the streets of Kyiv and also from the Ukrainian experts and some U.S. officials as well.
And that's available on voanews.com. Anna, we're going to wrap it up for today. Anna Chernikova visits us from Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
And just about 2,000 kilometers to the west of Kyiv, European Union leaders are gathering in Brussels. It's a two-day summit focused on a variety of important topics, but with Russia's invasion of Ukraine topping the agenda. VOA's Laurie London spoke with Thomas Graham. He's a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, to get insights into the discussions.
Well, it will be a serious conversation, and the alarm is growing for two reasons. First, I mean, the situation on the battlefield in Ukraine itself has been moving against Ukraine. The Russians are showing initiative across the entire front at this point, but that is coupled with the continued inability of the Biden administration to get its supplemental request for $60 billion through the U.S. Congress. And I think the European leaders are worried about whether that indeed will come through at some point and at the appropriate level, and whether Ukraine will have the type of support it needs to fortify the lines and consolidate its position against this Russian offensive. So you've got the offensive on the ground that is going against Ukraine at this point, and very serious questions about continued U.S. funding.
And as far as the European Union goes, there's a new sense of urgency due to the fact that Russia may not stop at Ukraine, and there are concerns that the U.S. may not be such a staunch protector of Europe. Given the election campaign, it's raising questions about fearing it needs to ramp up its own ability to provide its own security.
Well, you know, it's needed to do that for some time. I think, you know, recent developments have driven that point home. I think it's an exaggeration to say that Russia somehow succeeds in Ukraine, whatever that means, that the next thing it's going to do is to roll into the Baltic states in Poland. Nevertheless, I think it is clear that Europe faces a growing security challenge from Russia over the long term, and it needs to be able to build up its defense forces to deal with that, to deter in the first instance, and then to defend itself if for some reason it should come to a shooting war. That would be true no matter what the politics are in the United States. U.S. administrations have been pushing Europeans to provide more for their defense for many, many years now, actually probably since the beginning of the alliance, but clearly in the past decade or so, in part because the United States would like to be able to shift some of its resources from Europe to other places that we find a challenge for the United States in the future, so, you know, specifically the Indo-Pacific region, dealing with China as a major global power. But no matter what happens in November, there's going to be pressure on the Europeans to raise their defense spending, to develop a more robust defense policy, better coordinated defense policy to meet the target of 2% of GDP spent on defense that all NATO members are supposed to be aiming at this point. If Trump is elected in November, I think the situation becomes, I think, from a European standpoint, somewhat more dire given what Trump has said about his clear lack of enthusiasm for alliances, whether it be in Europe and elsewhere, would be a cause of concern. That, I think, sort of accelerates the problem, but it doesn't dramatically change the point that Europe does need to spend more on its defense, in part because the United States is not going to be able to back it up the way it has in past decades.
Lori Lunzen is the host of Issues in the News here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Thomas Graham from the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from The Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's another deepening crisis in the world happening in Haiti. Gang violence and killings continue to upend life in Port-au-Prince and other cities, and the government is not functioning in any meaningful way. The East African nation of Kenya sought to help by sending in security forces to lead a multinational force of peacekeepers. And while some Kenyans support President William Ruto's insistence on sending a police mission to Haiti, many others still wonder why their country should lead the force, given that other nations that are more powerful and better equipped have not stepped forward. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief Miriam Diallo has more.
Passions are running high in the streets of Nairobi over possibly deploying the country's police to Haiti.
Now, why are you sending police instead of sending military for such a thing? That's my question.
That's nothing, because we're going to lose our beloved ones. Kenya, we don't have that power like the other countries, like the United States.
I think that's a noble idea, because we are all human beings. Although people are complaining about the procedure which has been used,
we should urge the government of the day to at least follow the court orders.
Let me conclude my remarks.
President William Ruto, who recently signed a long-awaited bilateral accord with visiting Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry to pave the way for 1,000 Kenyan police officers to lead a proposed multinational UN-backed force that would help restore security in Haiti, insists it's the right thing to do.
It is a mission for humanity. It is a mission in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti.
However, signing that accord was immediately followed by a fierce battle between Haitian police and armed gangs who blocked Henry's return to the Caribbean nation and eventually pushed the prime minister to say he will resign as soon as a transitional council is put in place. Attorney Ekuru Aukot was among a group that filed a petition before Kenya's high court that argued sending the country's police to Haiti was unconstitutional. He says the recent signing was misleading.
First of all, it's a bogus agreement because it has no legitimacy, both in law and even on the person representing. Ariel Henry, for you to be able to enter into a contract, you must have capacity to enter into a contract.
And there are still problems whether this mission will go on or not, because all the legal benchmarks have still not been satisfied, he says.
When Jovenel Moïse was killed in July 2021, Ariel Henry was only supposed to be in power for 120 days. For him to take over the role of a prime minister under the constitution of Haiti, he must be ratified, vetted by parliament and approved by parliament. He was never. So really the question then coming to the agreement, who is this who actually signed this agreement with the Republic of Kenya?
George Musamali, a security consultant based in Nairobi, says it's time to rethink the Haitian issue.
What people have not focused on is the reason for this turmoil for all these years. Remember, we started talking about trouble in Haiti in 1805 when they first declared independence from the French. To date, Haiti has not seen peace. So basically, the solutions that we've been putting on the table, are they working?
There have been several unsuccessful interventions, including efforts by the United States and the United Nations. It's time to try something new, he says.
Basically, what they were going to do is to deal with the same people we call gangs that the American intervention tried in 1815, did not succeed. It tried again in 1994, did not work. We tried again under the UN in 2004, and it still did not work.
With such a hostile and volatile situation now in Haiti, Musamali says it's hard to envision that a military or a police intervention would work. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally today, news from the climate crisis. Pacific leaders are on high alert after U.S. scientists warned that the world is nearing a historic mass coral bleaching brought on by high water temperatures fueled by climate change. VOA's Jessica Stone reports.
Australia's Great Barrier Reef, typically an underwater rainbow of color, now parts of it are a spotted canvas of white. It's called a coral bleach, a symptom of soaring ocean temperatures that can lead to the death of a reef and the species who live there.
Marine heat waves are unfortunately increasing in frequency, magnitude, and severity. And this is directly a result of climate change and global warming.
The high levels of heat stress mapped in 2023 prompted the United States National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, to update its coral bleaching alert maps. In December, NOAA added three new levels, with level 5 predicting near-complete mortality for reefs. Marine ecologist Manzello says the world is on the brink of a historic coral mass bleaching event, the fourth in history.
Losing coral reefs is akin to, you know, chopping down the Amazon rainforest in terms of just losing species.
Species like tuna, a key food source and top export here in American Samoa. Manzello says he's already helping the U.S. territory monitor the worst-hit reefs in their waters. Palau's President Soringel Whips Jr., though, says the situation isn't hopeless and that corals can be resilient.
Every time we've had a coral bleaching event, some of those species have come back. We're just hoping that this event is not too widespread and too destructive.
Alan Friedlander, the chief scientist at National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project, says Palau, the Marshall Islands, and parts of Kiribati possess what's called super reefs, corals that recover more quickly from bleaching than other reefs.
These quote-unquote super reefs are areas that should be set aside for protection because they could be the seed bank for other places that have been impacted.
Seeding reefs with healthy baby corals is one of the few ways humans can speed up the reef recovery process, say scientists. Absent that, they say, it can take between 12 and 15 years for these ecological treasures to return to health. Jessica Stone, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.